You're listening to Just Ask the Question, Adventures in Reporting with your host, Brian Karam.
Hi, and welcome back to Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam, with our weekly review of the news, Just Ask the Press. And with me, as always, is former federal prosecutor Michael Zeldin and editor-at-large and chief White House correspondent for CQ Roll Call, John T. Bennett. Welcome, guys. This week, we're going to unpack the Supreme Court hearing on immunity for presidents, Donald Trump's week in Manhattan on trial. Meanwhile, President Joe Biden visited the Howard Stern Show. Marjorie Taylor Greene lost her bid to oust the Speaker of the House, or did she? And there have been a round of university protests against the war in the Middle East and Joe Biden. We'll have that, and we'll make fun of the NFL draft, that and much more. So stick around. We'll be right back.
In this modern age of misinformation and deceit, Just Ask the Questions newsletter cuts through the BS and gets to the truth with Brian's in-depth articles, columns, and exclusive content not released anywhere else. Get the scoop and stay in the know. Sign up for the Just Ask the Question newsletter now at substack.com/JATQ podcast.
Hi, we are back. It is Just Ask the Question, and I am your host, Brian Karam. As always, joining me for this episode of Just Ask the Press, former federal prosecutor Michael Zeldin and editor-at-large and chief White House correspondent for CQ Roll Call, John T. Bennett. And John's doing a jig. We're happy. So
Too much coffee. Way too much coffee.
Way too much coffee in an open window, and we won't touch that line. Anyway, let's start out with the week in Trump. Unfortunately, and how we covered it. First of all, Donald Trump is on trial in Manhattan. David Packer, a name if you say three times real fast will scare you, was the main witness this week, but there was also Gary Farrow and Trump's former assistant who testified as to the links and depths and breadths of the payoff to Stormy Daniels and Kara McDougal. And here to unpack some of that is Michael. Tell us what. Was it worth watching? That's the question I have. Was it worth anything? Did we find out anything we didn't know? Other than the fact that I will say that the National Enquirer is probably the colorectal cancer of journalism. But go ahead.
Well, first, you can't watch it because it's not televised, and you can't listen to it because it's not audio available. So you can only gather the information from reporters that are in the courtroom and coming out and then reporting on the questioning. And there's, you know, some pretty real-time reporting on the questions and the answers in the court for each witness. So what have we learned that isn't known if you really were following this all along? Not much, a little. But the basic argument is that Donald Trump is being held in a court of law accountable for his alleged conduct. Whether he's found guilty or not, the jury will determine. But that allegation of suppressing a story to aid his campaign and then to lie about it on the books and records, something which has been in the ozone here for damn near a decade, it seems, is now being tried before a jury of his peers, which they are. He is a New Yorker, and this is a New York jury. And so we'll get resolution, which I think is what the system is supposed to be about. Now, what did we learn from Pecker? What we learned from Pecker is that in Pecker's mind, the catch and kill of the stories of people like Karen McDougal and Stormy Daniels was specifically intended to help the Donald Trump for president campaign. It was not, according to Pecker, to prevent Melania from learning about this. It was not, according to Pecker, to shield Barron Trump from this. It was solely for the purpose of aiding the Trump campaign, which is a critical part of what has to be proved by the DA's office to make a case here. They need still to show the business records aspect of it, that it was that this payment was falsely represented on the books and records of the company. But in terms of one element of proof that has to be established, Pecker was not impeached during cross-examination of his principal point, which was this money was paid to these women, especially for exclusively for the purpose of aiding the Trump campaign. The second witness was a essentially secretary, administrative assistant to Trump. She had been in that role for decades. And all she was there to do principally was to say Donald Trump had the names of Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal in his Rolodex. He had Stormy. That was the Rolodex card that Trump had. So the simple point being, he can't say, as he has often said, I don't know this woman. I don't know how I got into a picture with her. Her allegations are false. All she was there to say is, yeah, but he had her in his Rolodex. And now we're up to the third witness, who is the banker who was dealing with Michael Cohen on the home equity loan. That he had to get in order to pay the $130,000 to hush Stormy Daniels. So that's what we've gotten so far. If you say, well, who's up, who's down, I think I would say is that the evidence is presently going in as the prosecutor's office wants it to go in, without a lot of dispute as to their theory. And the cross-examination, though it makes a point here and there, an inconsistency or some reading of the language of a document, the overall story has remained.
So, but the problem, here's a so question for you, and then John, I got to ask you a bunch of Trump questions. But Michael, the big question is, will this case hinge on Michael Cohen? Because his credibility has been questioned numerous times. He's served time in prison, and they're gonna beat him up on that, the Trump's people. Does it hinge on believing Michael Cohen, or is the paper trail going to be enough?
I think if the prosecution is going to win, Cohen is going to have to be believed, and that his testimony is going to have to be supported by the documentation. I don't think the documentation all by itself wins the case. I don't think that Cohen all by himself wins the case. But Cohen all by himself has the capacity to lose the case by creating a reasonable doubt. And what I've said to you, Brian, over the years of watching Michael Cohen is that his animus is so clear that he does make himself vulnerable to the, to the accusation that this is all about revenge and that the truth has nothing to do with it. Well, I understand that. And that if they can paint him, if they can upset him, he's a volatile witness. He wasn't great in prior testimony. If they can upset him and then by that argue to the jury at the end, this is a vengeful, scorned man, if you will, who seeks revenge, as his book title says and as his podcast is all about, you should have a reasonable doubt as to its truthfulness and therefore acquit. And that's what they'll argue.
John, when we look at Trump coming out of these hearings, anything strike you different about him from when he was in the Oval?
Well, Michael described Mr. Cohen as scorned and vengeful, and for a second I thought he was talking about me. So give me a second here to gather myself, because I plead no contest, Your Honor. Let's see. Is Trump damaged politically? Well, we have seen a narrowing in recent weeks, really, I guess a month now, Joe Biden closing the gap both nationally and in a number of swing states and a number of could-be swing states. The top of that list is North Carolina. So there is this tightening in the polls. It's hard to link it to anything because, you know, when I dive into these polls, I don't know what to make of them, and I've been doing this a while. You know, Biden gets just really awful marks on the economy, high prices, foreign policy, crime, just terrible. I'm talking 30s, high 20s, you know, mid 30s. Trump gets a little better on those. You know, he hovers in the low 40s. It's not stellar. He's almost 50% or around 50% Trump is on the economy, stuff like that. But so Biden's way down here on these issues. But when it comes to the question of who you vote for, it's dead even. So something's happening here. There's some force that despite voters just sour mood about Joe Biden, he's still right in this thing. I mean, this is a dead heat. You can also look at it and say Trump's facing 80-something charges. He's in court almost every day. Biden's on the trail talking about what he's doing for people. Biden is handing out money. They timed both the infrastructure bill implementation and the CHIPS and Science Act implementation, which a lot of federal grant money. So he's going around literally handing out money in his president job.
I want to move on to the Trump trial in Manhattan, if we can, Michael. I guess what I want to talk about is, I'm sorry, not the Trump trial, but the Supreme Court hearing on immunity that came down this week. If you can unpack that for me. Trump has, I keep looking at this. Is there any way in hell that the Supreme Court would adjudicate themselves out of business? I mean, if you give a president that much immunity, hell, you'd have to give it to Biden as well. And any president could say, hey, I just don't care for the Supreme Court anymore. To hell with it. Or he could just have you executed using Trump's attorney's own logic. But I'll let you unpack that for me because I'm still in disbelief. John, thanks for coming back. We'll get back to you in a second on that. Don't know what happened to you, but go ahead, Michael.
The court held an argument that lasted 2.5 hours on the question of the scope of presidential immunity. Donald Trump's position is all former presidents and all presidents are entitled to absolute immunity for everything that they do. It's the reminiscence of the Nixon line, if the president does it, it must be legal. That's what he's essentially arguing. The Supreme Court didn't seem to take that argument all that seriously. I don't think you'll get a ruling that says the president of the United States is immune from prosecution or a former president is immune from prosecution for acts undertaken while they are in office. I do think, though, that we will get an opinion that says there is an area of conduct that the president is entitled to some form of immunity for official acts. This is, I think, going to be similar to the civil law, you know, cases in this area. In the civil law cases, Nixon versus Fitzgerald, the court has said he's immune from civil prosecution for acts taken in his office in the outer, even up to the outer perimeter of his official duties. So they've defined that there's a outer limit of official duties that prevent the president from being civilly sued. But if it's not in that outer perimeter, if it's his private conduct, he can be sued. I think we're going to see a similar sort of ruling in the criminal space, that there's going to say there are some types of behavior that may technically be criminal, but which are still within his official duties, and therefore he should be immune from it. You know, you've heard stories, hypotheticals in these things about if there is a drone strike by an American president that kills an American citizen overseas, or if there is a border policy that results in something, can the president be sued for that, charged for that criminally? And I think the court is going to say, no, there are things that might technically touch on criminality, but which are within the scope of his official duties, that we're going to protect that from taking place. But when you get to the private stuff, I think that he's going to lose. Trump's position is going to lose 7-2 or 6-3, something along those lines. And the question is going to be, the big question is going to be, well, what happens then? Let's say the Supreme Court says 6-3 that official acts of the president are immune from criminal prosecution, but private ones aren't. We're going to send this back to the court saying there's an official private line of demarcation, and you courts below have to figure out on a case-by-case basis whether or not the president is being charged criminally with a private or a public lawsuit. And the question is going to be, how do they do that? Do they do that on the papers themselves? Do they have to have a mini hearing? Is that mini hearing, if it occurs, or if their ruling on the paper occurs, can it be appealed immediately before a trial? None of that stuff is clear. So you could end up with a situation on the Trump never goes to trial scenario of they send it back to the court. They say to the court, you have to have some sort of mini hearing on this. And then at the end of the mini hearing, if he's found to be in trial for private behavior, does he get to appeal that to the Court of Appeals? Does he get to appeal that to the Supreme Court? If that's the process, then the likelihood of this being able to take place within, you know, the time frame before the trial, before the election, is pretty slim. If they say, and they have to say it relatively quickly, they have until the end of June, really, but they could do it more quickly. If they say, yeah, this goes back to the court, and the court can decide on the papers whether this implicates private or official conduct, and then we'll go forward, and there's no appeal until the end of the trial, then you could have a trial. And the interesting thing was, Brian, that in the argument, the justices were asking Trump's lawyer, Sauer, well, let me ask you this about this. When he did this, as alleged in the indictment, would you say that's private or public? And he said, private. Would you say this, public or private? Private. So they made him go through parts of the indictment where he was saying, this is private, this is private, this is private, this may be official, this is probably official, that sort of stuff. And so, you know, in a sense, the counsel for Trump admitted that in the pleadings, there are a lot of things that are private conduct where he is candidate Trump and not President Trump. And so, you know, one of the things that the Jack Smith people could do if they wanted to is cull out some of the stuff that is, you know, arguably official conduct and just try them on the private conduct. The interesting thing, though, is you had this question and answer, I think it was with Chief Justice Roberts, where the defense was trying to say, well, you know, you just call that stuff out of the indictment and then you go forward on the private stuff. And the response from the government was, well, you have to have that stuff in there for context. I think Roberts or somebody called it a one-legged stool. If you take it, you've got to be able to say that maybe it's not a crime for the president to have called Mike Pence. But if you don't have that call in the indictment to understand the context in which the broader conspiracy was taking place, then you don't really have a viable a theory of prosecution. So all
so
of that.
Bottom line, do you think this is going to delay this trial until after the election?
The answer is I don't know, Brian. It depends on what I'm talking about here is it depends on how the Supreme Court structures it. They can structure it that this can go to trial well before the election, or they can structure it that it doesn't have a chance of going before the election. So, but I think, Brian, the bottom line is I do not think Trump wins on absolute immunity. I don't think he wins on that.
He can't. That would give him the right of a monarch and negate the Congress and the Supreme Court. So I don't see that happening. John, I want to get to you on before we were sorely interrupted on the Manhattan and on the Supreme Court. I guess the question I wanted to ask you going back to the Trump trial in Manhattan is, does it appear to you, I mean, the polls aside, when we see Trump coming afterwards, when we see him speaking, you and I were both there during his White House years, does he look the same as he did, as energetic as he did then? And on the Supreme Court, when you listen to these arguments, is there any doubt what, I think it all adds up to they just want to delay, but Donald Trump has made a campaign message out of his bad luck. Do you think at the end of the day that that is wearing thin, or do you think he can continue that?
I think he can continue that all the way through Election Day. There is, I know you said polling aside, but there is a new poll out this week, was a new poll out, excuse me, last week, that says that, you know, a big majority of voters do not believe a conviction in the Manhattan case or any of the other cases should disqualify Trump from being president again. So Biden is narrowing things, but on the flip side, the polling doesn't support that the reason Biden is narrowing is because of these this trial and all the other legal stuff. It just doesn't seem like it's backed up.
But John, can I ask you a question about that? You described it as saying a conviction shouldn't be disqualifying. Well, constitutionally, it's not disqualifying unless it's for insurrection or something. But do they believe, do the polls have data which reflects that if he is convicted, though not disqualifying, would be something that would be a tipping point for them in terms of whether they would vote for him or against him?
As always with Trump, it's a mixed bag. There have been polls where a slight majority said it would change their mind and they would look for another candidate. But those polls were really being taken when there were GOP primary opponents. And of course, Trump steamrolled all of those folks, and there are none. He's the presumptive nominee. And I just don't think the question would be, would people sit it out? Maybe some independent voters. Maybe there's still some swing voters who were considering these two gentlemen. I think the bigger question is, you know, if he's convicted, and it looks like this is the only show in town right now is the Manhattan trial. There's no other. I mean, they better get it together in these other cases if they want to start a trial and maybe get a decision before Election Day. So no, the polls don't really support that the trials are going to be what tilts this thing one way or another. I was talking to some strategists in recent weeks for various reporting projects, and strategists think it's gonna come down to name calling down the stretch in October, and I tend to agree with that.
Well, let's go back to speaking of name calling. The first question I asked you: you see him come out of the trial in Manhattan?
Oh,
does he look like the same guy to you as 4 years ago?
No, of course not. You know, one day I noticed, I believe it was Thursday. It was one of the days they wrapped up early this week. I believe it was Tuesday then. He walked out, and it was about 2:30, 2:45 by the time he headed toward the pool and the cameras in the courthouse there. And he was kind of lunging, you know, from step to step, from foot to foot. And he didn't look like himself. He didn't look energetic at all. He looked lethargic. He looks like he might be a tad, and who amongst us isn't, a tad bigger than he was. And he looked tired. He looks very tired. I think his face is noticeably, you know, the bags under his eyes have always been there. I think they're puffier. He looks like a 77, 78-year-old man who's got a lot of stress right now. And he doesn't look as energetic, not at all. I've noticed he doesn't talk for as long as he did in the White House. He talks, you know, 7-8, the poolers who are doing a great job in the hallway in the courtroom, you know, they're saying he spoke for 6 minutes, he spoke for 7 minutes, he spoke for 4.5 minutes. So he's not doing that as much. And he does look tired. And I'm sure sitting, you know, he's complained about the courtroom. We've never gotten the straight medical information. Does he have arthritis, as a lot of men his age do, and sitting that long, and he's complained the courtroom is cold. So is he sore? I'm sure he's stiff. I would be stiff. I'm 30 years younger than him, more than 30 years younger than him, sitting there all day in a cold courtroom. And so he doesn't look the same, but neither does Joe Biden. And Axios had some reporting this week. And I noticed part of this, I was on pool duty in the Oval on April 15th, and I looked down at President Biden's shoes for the same reason the Axios reporters have been looking down at his shoes, and he was wearing dress sneakers with a very grippy sole. And now, at his own request, President Biden is having his aides kind of form a phalanx around him as he walks to and from Marine One on the South Lawn because he saw himself on TV, and he doesn't think his gait is going to help him, G-A-I-T, get reelected. So now he's trying to block the cameras. So neither of these guys looked like they did 3 or 4 years.
I think it was just like he wanted to pretend like he couldn't even hear us because we shout questions at him. I'm talking to my guys.
Well, one thing I've noticed, I mean, neither of these guys look like they did 3 or 4 years ago. One has all these legal stresses, and the other has the most stressful job in the world. And voters are going to have to decide who looks more up for it.
You know, it's sort of sad when you think about it.
No, it's extremely sad when you
Which
think
part?
About it.
No, but I'm saying, I'm talking about the way what the media thinks is important, whether he's wearing sneakers or not. I mean, for God's sakes, FDR was paraplegic, and we wouldn't photograph him with his crutches. We only photographed him seated in his chair because that was the dignified thing to do for a president of the United States. Now we're, sort of covering his sneakers, and we're making it seem as if it's something that is dispositive of his qualifications to be president. Just
we didn't make him 81.
Crazy. No, I understand that. But what I'm saying is that there was a time where it was understood that whether you were in a wheelchair or you walked with grippy sneakers had nothing to do with anything other than you were in a wheelchair and you wore grippy sneakers. Because if FDR is running for president now, are you talking about his wheelchair and that he's not as agile as a non-wheelchair bound person?
One thing we have to keep in context, FDR was 63 when he died and was considered an old man. And no,
That's not the point,
Michael.
That's not the point.
We are in uncharted territory when it comes to reporting on this stuff. And that's why you have the press doing a poor job of putting together what does matter, because we've never had to do it before. And we have younger reporters without the historical context to put it in context. That's the point. I don't think that we're up to the job, and that's one of my biggest complaints, is that we're not up to the job. And to the point that at 63 he was considered older, he was afforded dignities that we do not afford today to the president, but we seem to afford to Trump. I think we err in that. But go ahead, John.
I want to ask Michael, let's say I'm a pooler at the courthouse in Manhattan, and I notice Trump is not wearing his usual lace-up, slick-bottomed dress loafers. He's wearing some kind of sneaker with, big or like orthopedic sneakers that Senator Carl Levin used to wear around the Capitol with these huge rubber soles. Do you want me to report that in a pool report, or do you want me to keep that to myself because he's a former president?
I don't think it's relevant to anything, John, is my question.
It does speak to their health. It does. It says something.
Well, maybe it speaks to their desire to be
You're saying we're making the assumption it speaks to their health without knowing whether or not it speaks to their health.
Yeah, the point is,
well, we asked the White House and they won't tell us a damn thing. So,
well, but look, you watch a lot of sports on TV. And if you watch those former athletes who are commentators, many of whom are in excellent shape still, they're all wearing sneakers. And is it because they're old or because they've been so beat up on the football fields or other fields that you can't wear whether you don't ask that question of them. You're asking them the question of whether or not their point of view is
correct. I have to wonder if Donald Trump was the one in the Oval Office who suddenly changed his shoes. I think we'd be having a different conversation. I do.
And I guess my point is I'm not talking about the double standard here. I think there is a double standard. I'm not talking about that so much as we've got stuff to cover in this podcast today that are very important topics. And here we are talking about shoes That's what my complaint is. And that's what I think this is just – this is not to criticize us. God forbid I should criticize us. The question is, we've taken up, you know, 5 or 7 minutes on talking about shoes. It's been a fun conversation, but it's going to impact – it's going to, you know, capitate what we can talk about with respect to college protests or other important things. And that's what I'm saying is happening on the news shows where there's limited amount of time to cover important things, and they spend 5 to 7 minutes of their half hour on shoes. And it just
CNN is wall-to-wall Trump trial coverage. They're not talking about shoes.
Time out for this important commercial message. You are correct. I'll end this conversation this way. I wrote an article saying it's all the media's fault this week. You can see it in Salon. I'm going to plug that real quick. Yeah. Are we unavailable and unable to report on the things that matter? Yes. But guess what? The American public loves to talk about shoes. And we're there to, unfortunately, now you're speaking about the problem with the media. We're there for money. So we're going to do a short break. When we come back, we're going to talk more about shoes. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Hey, Just Ask the Question podcast listeners. If you've got a second, head on over to Twitter and follow our official page, JATQ Podcast. That's JATQ Podcast.
In this modern age of misinformation and deceit, Just Ask the Questions newsletter cuts through the BS and gets to the truth with Brian's in-depth articles, columns, and exclusive content not found anywhere else. Get the scoop and stay in the know. Sign up for the Just Ask the Question newsletter now at substack.com/JATQ podcast.
Hi, we are back. It is Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam, with our weekly review of the news, Just Ask the Press. With me, of course, is former federal prosecutor Michael Zeldin and editor-at-large and chief White House correspondent for CQ Roll Call, John T. Bennett. And when we left, we were discussing the important message of shoes. Actually, what I'm going to say is this. Michael, both of you made excellent points. And I'll end it this way. The press has to be better. We have to cover things that matter. At the same time, if you're reporting on shoes, I think the point is that for some, it does matter. But we make assumptions about what it is just to be seen in tennis shoes without actually conferring to decide what it is that it actually means. So with that said, I'm going to move on to the Biden on the Howard Stern show. Talk about something. And John, you and I, we're listening to that. I was taken aback on a couple of fronts. First of all, and I'll just lay it out there. Listening to it, I heard Biden's life story, and there have been articles that saying, hey, this is the type of campaigning that Biden should be doing because he relates to people in a working class environment, and it shows how close his family is. But I was taken aback because he afforded Howard Stern nearly an hour of time in the press in trying to ask real issues, to your point, Michael, earlier, in trying to ask real questions on real issues. We've not had that opportunity. And Biden, at one point in time, flipped the script on Stern and said, hey, why does the media suck today? And he said, I think it's because they're afraid. And Biden said, I haven't figured it out yet. But yes, fear seems to be part of it. Yeah, I think fear is part of it. And I think Donald Trump and Joe Biden are afraid to sit down with people who will ask them real questions. The thing I took out of this more than anything else was my complete dissatisfaction with the last few presidents for their ability to sit down and answer real questions, which is why sometimes we end up talking about their footwear. But go ahead, John.
Which part of the interview would you like me to start with?
Let's start with them attacking us, saying that, you know, we're afraid that, I mean, I was like, excuse me, I was never afraid to, I never knew you to be afraid to ask a question. I knew that they were afraid for us to ask questions.
Yes, Brian, thanks for the question. And let's start with how this went down. There was a big gaping empty hole in the president's public schedule for Friday that came out on Thursday, released by the White House. I'm sure other journalists, but me, being back on the beat for 3 weeks, decided, and you know, I've been very polite in my interactions, and I decided this isn't how you should do this because, and I'll play the double standard card again, because I wrote these stories when Democratic lawmakers and strategists and everybody else under the sun on that side thought Trump was doing something nefarious or not transparent with his schedule or scheduling or whatever. I asked the White House, what the heck's going on here? What's the president doing? Why is he staying in New York overnight, New York City overnight? That's expensive. Who's paying for it? The taxpayer, the campaign, some combination of the two. Why is he not coming back to Washington Thursday night after a fundraiser? You can land the little Air Force One in Westchester County, flying back to JBA. He's in bed by 11. So why isn't he coming back? And then why is he not coming back until the afternoon on Friday? What is the president was at that point off the grid.
And we had no clue.
I'm asking
that
Friday morning, what's going on? I don't even get a, like, off the record, John, stay tuned. You're going to find out in a minute. Even the Trump White House would have given me that. So these guys just went dark, and he shows up on CERN. I get it. Security, Secret Service probably didn't love that he was going, you know, they didn't, but the White House staff, maybe they didn't want protesters to show up. So, but there is a, like, they snuck him in, right? That's how it feels. And if you're the big, strong, most powerful person in the world, you shouldn't be sneaking around. And you work for the people, okay? So I didn't like how that went. And I didn't like the lack of answering that I got. So it was Joe Biden's life story. That's clearly what was negotiated here. And you remember, Hillary Clinton has been still gets criticized for not doing a Stern interview in 2016. Stern has contended that he has a lot of independent voters that listen, and it could have helped her beat Donald Trump in 2016. We'll never know. So Biden decides maybe to learn that lesson of
Clinton's life. Well, I think it's also because he wanted to stick it to Trump a little bit, because Trump got thumped by Stern, and Trump reached out and criticized Stern after being he was a guest on Stern's show many, many times.
Right. So this was reintroducing Joe Biden to, I think, independent voters in the states that are going to matter. Stern does have a huge following, even though it's subscription on Sirius XM. I was able to listen. I was able to listen real time. I know you were too. So there was a lot of things that I knew. I didn't know that, you know, Joe Biden felt suicidal after his first wife and daughter died in a car accident. He talked about therapy. He talked about a lot of personal things. You know, we hear about his father and his mother and his uncle and his grandfather almost on a daily basis. So we know this family's close, and it always has been. And he's kept that alive now as the patriarch of the family. So there wasn't a lot of new there. He did say that he would debate Donald Trump. Trump's camp immediately kind of accepted. They'd already said they wanted to debate. So that was a little new. But there wasn't a lot of new here. This was about the story of Joe Biden and Joe Biden's family. And, you know, and he has had a ton of loss in his life. Of course, his son, Bo, died.
That was touching. You cannot listen to that without being touched. Right. I get right. That. Yeah. My question was why won't he sit down with a serious journalist? And maybe to your point, Michael, there aren't any serious journalists, but he to sit down for that hour to talk about issues and answers, I think would have been as productive, if not more productive. Maybe not with the independent, and I get what they were trying to do, but if you're going to sit down with Howard Stern, I mean, sit down with Dan Rather, if nobody else. Sit down with, you know, Sam Donaldson, or sit down with any of those people that have the gravitas to sit down. I'd love to have him for an hour. You would too. Sure. And to talk about serious issues.
I disagree with the notion that there aren't any serious journalists that Joe Biden could sit down with for 30 minutes or an hour.
I think there are plenty that aren't, but I think there are plenty that are.
You, Steve Holland from Reuters, Kelly O'Donnell is the president. Kelly O'Donnell is the president of the White House Correspondents Association. The big dinner is tonight. why not sit down with Kelly? She's not going to pull any punches in a one-on-one. That's going to be a serious interview. Peter Alexander from NBC, Karen Travers from ABC. I could go on and on. There are plenty of serious journalists that he could sit down with that are in that room almost every day. He could come out to the briefing room and do a press conference and talk to all of us at once. We haven't seen that
yet. And he's never done that.
If you're not doing it, then you must not want to do it, or you fear some kind of political blowback if you do it. That's the only thing you can conclude.
Michael?
I don't know why he does it. I don't know why he doesn't do it. I just can't figure out what the campaign strategy is. Personally, I will never forgive Howard Stern for his misogyny, and I don't know why anyone would appear on his show. Yeah, he gets great guests. I see little snippets on the social media when he talks to musicians. But I find his past and how he rose to fame so objectionable that I don't understand why people would go on his show, period. I get it. He has a big audience, but I wouldn't do it. And, you know, if I run for president and I go on the Howard Stern show, you can point down my hypocrisy. I just wouldn't. I wouldn't pick him.
Michael, as your campaign manager, I wouldn't let you do it.
Thank you. I wouldn't pick him. I think it's offensive to women that anyone appears on his show. But, you know, what do I know? And I don't know why he would pick him. And I understand why he would go in quietly, because it's, you know, New York, and that's a problem these days. When we get to Columbia University, we'll see what a problem New York is these days. But I just have said over and over and over that Biden is best when he's being Biden and he's out among the people who seem to relate to him as a human being. And he just doesn't do enough of it.
I agree with that, but I'd like to see him do more of that, more of sitting down with reporters. As for Howard Stern's misogyny, he reinforced that in the interview with Biden when he said, hey, did you ever look back at the girls that turned you down for a date and said, you know, hey, I'm the president. And he goes, you know, that would be the first thing I'd do. And to his credit, the president kind of, you know, dodged that misogynistic bullet. But it's hard for me to understand why the president of the United States would go on a radio show with a guy who was famous for Fart Man and getting women to engage in masturbatory pleasure on the air. I find that offensive, as you do. But I understand, as to your point, John, why he did it. It's to reach some of those independent voters in those swing states. Well, go ahead.
I'm sorry.
Last word on this.
Okay. One day, I believe it was Wednesday or Thursday of this week, Biden was giving remarks to a home builders association. So it was Wednesday of this week, here in Washington at the very Hilton where the big dinner is tonight. And he was talking about Donald Trump's moral failings and statements over the years, a lot of what Michael was just talking about, which I think is a great point. So last night, so there he's talking about Trump's moral failings. Friday, he shows up on the Howard Stern show. Everyone can go back on YouTube and listen to a Donald Trump appearance on the Howard Stern show before Stern changed his show into an interview format when it was still raunchy. And they're talking about this. That's where Trump said if Ivanka wasn't his daughter, they'd probably be dating. Howard Stern looks at Ivanka Trump's father and calls her a piece of ass. They then go on to talk about the Miss Universe or USA. I can't remember which one he owned at the time. Miss America, maybe, that Trump owned at the time. And Trump is boasting about going into the dressing room. He's the only man in there because he owned it and he could do whatever he wanted. And alludes to they had to engage in sexual acts with him because they were contractually obligated, and Stern is laughing. So what, Mr. President, about those moral failings? And then you go on the show anyway. I get the blowtorch audience, but I mean, I guess you just have to be willing to do anything to beat Donald Trump.
Well, it's a question as to if he's going to, honestly, I still cannot believe that this race is this close And I'm still unconvinced that both of these guys will be on the ticket.
At the end of this,
fall.
Brian, I texted you this, I tweeted this out. So Stern says, thank you, Mr. President, for coming in. He says, thank you, Howard. And you know, he goes to break. And the thing that plays next is a Baba Booey bumper jingle as they're, you know, as the bridge to their Sirius XM. They do have some commercials there, a lot of house ads too.
Yeah.
So they were going to a break and it's Baba Booey, Baba Booey, Baba Booey. It's just, it was too much. It's just too much.
And with that thought, we're going to Baba Booey into another break and then we'll be back. Stick around, Baba Booey. We'll be right back.
Hey, you. Yeah, you. We're talking to you, and we need your help. As you probably know, independent journalism is a vital pillar of our democracy. Like everything else, it's not free. We're asking all longtime listeners of the show to help support us by becoming a member on Patreon. For the price of a latte, you can help guard democracy. Join us today at patreon.com/JATQ podcast to help us keep bringing you the podcast you love and the facts you deserve.
Hi, we're back. It's Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karen, with our weekend review show called Just Ask the Press with former federal prosecutor Michael Zeldin and editor-at-large and chief White House correspondent for CQ Roll Call, John T. Bennett. Before we left, we were discussing Baba Booey. We were discussing Biden on the Howard Stern Show, and we have, I tell you what, we've hit it all pretty good so far this week. I'm going to next go to Marjorie Taylor Greene. I think one of the things about Marjorie Taylor Greene is she has now been attacked by members of her own party for wanting to get rid of the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson. And it seems like one of the untold, underreported, almost unspoken things that Joe Biden has done. And Michael, this goes in, this is a reflection upon your comment earlier about some of the shallow stuff that we report on. One of the things that's underreported is the fact that Joe Biden, in at least two or three different instances, has been able to come up with a bipartisan solution to problems that we face and has done very well internationally. None of that has played well in Marjorie Taylor Greene's eyes. And because there was a Ukraine aid bill that was signed, she had threatened to oust Michael Johnson, and she got leveled by her own, by members of her own party. Of course, I don't know if they're really members of her party. The MAGA party and the Republican Party are two different things, although they say they're the same. Anyway, John, let's talk about that. Is Marjorie Taylor Greene done? Is her influence on the wane? Or can she successfully oust the Speaker?
That is still a question for House Democrats to answer, because if Matt Gaetz and one or two other Republicans stick with her, she doesn't even need them to force a vote on ousting Johnson. But if Democrats don't give Johnson enough votes to override whoever joins her in the actual ousting vote, then she still has the influence and the power. They've been gone for a week. House Democrats left saying that because Johnson gave them the Ukraine aid bill they've been asking for God, what, 8-10 months, that they would save him if she insists on this ouster vote. We'll see when they get back on Tuesday if House Democrats are still in a giving mood. I believe it will stick, because they wouldn't need more than 50 or 75 votes from the Democrats to keep Johnson in there and just make this a one afternoon affair, you know, and just keep moving. There is, we talked about this last week, there's actually some bipartisan momentum. I was talking to a White House official this week over coffee, and, you know, they're moving to things like the FAA reauthorization. That's kind of important. You know, everybody likes to ride on them airplanes, Brian. And the FAA. I'm an Airbus guy. I'll leave it at that. And so they've got to do that. That's usually like a 5-year extension. It's on a temporary bridge extension right now. The White House would like to kick that way down the road. And there are members of both parties that, you know, they don't want to be doing these extensions, these 6 months extensions for something like the FAA. You know how many flights every day take off domestically and internationally? So they want to get that done. That's going to have to be another bipartisan vote tally. The NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Bill, at the end of the year, of course, they're getting serious about that. That's going to be bipartisan. So there's some momentum here. There's talk of a health package maybe at the end of the year, maybe in the lame duck. But you got to write it first. So there's some.
But there's, will Marjorie be successful in ousting Michael?
Sorry, that was a long way of leading into that. They have so much that they still want to do, and they have bipartisan momentum. And Johnson's figured out ways to get things done. And he knows what Kevin McCarthy knew and what Mitch McConnell knows is that Republicans need something to run on in November. And he's giving those moderates, those 17 moderates that Republicans need to hold the majority in the House, Johnson is giving them things to run on. So no, I don't think she will be successful. And I think she knows that. And I think that's why she hasn't asked for the vote. All she has to do is she's introduced the motion. She just has to ask that it be considered privileged. And that forces the vote. I think Democrats will save Johnson unless he does something to really upset them. And I just don't see, I don't think going to Columbia University is enough right now for House Democrats to agree to what would just throw the brakes on the House for another 2 weeks while they try to find someone that all the Republicans could agree, because the Democrats aren't going to vote for anybody, I think, right now other than Mike Johnson. And again, he gave them that Ukraine bill, and I think that's so key that he did that. And he might be figuring this out a little bit, so keep an eye on Mike Johnson, everybody. I'm telling you, keep an eye on this guy. He's maneuvering. He's posturing. Keep an eye. You heard it here first.
Keep it. Michael, I want to go back to what we were talking about earlier, because this is – I like the passion, and I love the argument about us reporting on shallow ice. This is one very in-depth issue that we have covered. What do you think the press should be doing that we're not doing instead of covering the shallow stuff? How should we improve?
Policy. I think that we've talked about this before. Biden has policies for his second term in office, objectives he'd like to achieve. Trump has policies that he'd like to achieve were he reelected. I think there are stark differences between the two. And I think that that's what the presidency of each of these candidates will be made of, not the shoes they wear, or even necessarily the TV shows that they appear or don't appear on. But if elected, what will their second term in office be constituted of as a policy matter? And I don't see very much of that, because that requires reporters to actually read and analyze and articulate.
Ding, 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 ding. I get
and they don't do it, because it's much easier to say who's up, who's down, who's wearing sneakers, who's not wearing sneakers. Does he look old? Has he gained weight? That's easy stuff. It's just what is that's right before our eyes. All you're saying is, I see a tree. I see a bush. Oh, there's a dog. As opposed to, you know, the environmental policies that allow us to have trees and bushes and dogs, and what the impact of fossil fuels may have on seeing those dogs and bushes and trees 20 years from now. That takes research. And I just don't see anyone, I don't see people doing that a lot. And maybe it's the incentives of the media just don't allow for that the cutbacks in the newsrooms don't allow for, you know, deep investigative reporting any longer. Look, the New York Times doesn't even have a sports section anymore. They've outsourced it to The Athletic or whatever that thing is. So they bought The Athletic and all their reports. We're in a sad state in our media. But that's what you've asked me. What would I like to see them do? That's what I'd like to see them do.
It sounds like we need to get Michael a subscription to CQ.com, because there's a lot of quality policy reporting going on, but it's behind a paywall. That might be why you're not seeing a lot of that. Politico Pro, Bloomberg Pro, I believe that's what Bloomberg, whatever they're calling it. So there, that is out there, but it's paywall.
I get it, but that's not going to the number of subscribers to those in depth.
Oh, I know. I mean, look, I know.
Foreign Affairs covers stuff, and so does Dissent and Commentary and all those types of magazines, but no one's reading them. Or very few people are reading it, or not enough people are going to be reading them to make it be outcome determinative of an election. I'm talking about mainstream broadcast media.
I know.
So I get it. You send me a subscription. I'll read your.
We're not sending anything. We sell those.
Yeah. Well, that's
this can be a problem with DC journalism. Is the policy stuff now is behind a paywall. That's for large corporations, defense contractors, healthcare companies. That's for those guys to interpret the policies, analyze the policies, find the loopholes, and make more money. That can be a problem.
Yeah, here's the problem. There are fewer and fewer reporters, fewer and fewer companies owning most of what you see, read, or hear, and it's all geared to money. That's the problem. Look, I'll go back to the Courier Journal Louisville Times, which was my goal to work at for my entire life. At its apex, at its high, at its best point, it has circulation of 380,000, I think it was. It had bureaus of a dozen in the state capital. It had a bureau of six or seven in D.C. It had bureaus in New York, London, with a staff of about 250. Today, it has a circulation not of 280 or 380,000, but 20,000. And it has a staff of 20. It is damn near impossible for you to do anything more than the most shallowest of reporting, because you don't have reporters who know what they're doing, and there are not enough of them. And Michael, you're preaching to the choir with all of that. The point part, sometimes those things that we consider the shallowest are indicative of a larger problem, right? Whether it's dementia or it's age or it's, what are we considering with the president? We don't put those or frame those arguments very well because we don't have the reporters to do it. So what you end up with is, you know, this is the tree, dirt, dog, cat, you know, almost like a Trump sobriety test. And so it doesn't, I think that's the biggest problem. We just don't have the people to cover.
Let me just add to what I was saying about the policy stuff, the substantive stuff goes behind the paywall. I can't blame DC media companies for doing that, because when and I've worked several places, you know, if you're not working for a trade publication and you put a lot of that stuff out in front of the paywall, it doesn't perform. It doesn't get traffic. It doesn't get picked up. It doesn't do anything on social media. So if you're one of these companies and you sense there's a niche market that you can make money by putting it behind a subscription paywall, why the hell wouldn't you? And that's what they've done. It's just smart business. And I hate to do this. The reader is the market. Okay, we're in front of the paywall, we're responding to market forces. If the readers wanted that stuff, we'd give it to them for free. They don't want it. They want to know about shoes and name calling. So that's what we're going to give them. Because as Tony Soprano said, we're running a business here.
That's the problem. It has come down to money. Oh, money matters. What Ben Bagdikian once said, your ultimate responsibility isn't to the owners, it isn't to your job, it's to your readers. To inform your readers, that's why you're there. We don't do it. And the simple fact of the matter is why we don't do it is because the consolidation of the media, the disintegration of the bumper guards that kept us in line, all of that has led us to be, you know, money matters more than anything else. So it's the lowest common denominator, journalism. And until we put some of the guardrails back on, and until we break up media monopolies and make us more competitive, we're not going to get better. I don't care if there's all kinds of talk about, you know, making it a nonprofit situation. Why not just give tax breaks to media owners? Why not just help out and bust up the media monopolies? The politicians created this problem that they now complain about. And I blame every president since Ronald Reagan. Michael, I'll give you the your last word on it.
Well, I like blaming Ronald Reagan for everything, that we've seen in the media. I think that the getting rid of the fairness rules and other fairness things doctrine. Like that have really changed for the worse the landscape of the media. That which got us Rush Limbaugh and that type of journalism because the rules were changed for it, I think has had calamitous impact on the media.
I think it's cataclysmic. And I'll tell you, if you want to see what today's media is really all about, go and listen or watch or read David Pecker's testimony in Manhattan. His catch and kill, his idea that it's all about money, he stepped up. And what he did, as I said, is the colorectal cancer version of journalism. But that's where it all is, making money. John, your last words, and we're gonna get out of here with that, but I'll let you plug whatever you want and give you the last words.
No plug this week. I'll just end with Baba Booey.
Michael.
So my podcast is That Said with Michael Zeldin. As you know, I read books and talk to the authors about it. I've got my interview with Fareed Zakaria on his great book, Age of Revolutions. I will interview him Monday in 2 days from now and release it on the following Friday, probably. And onward and upward, you know, I say where people should talk, journalists should talk about policy. I also think that people should read books. And that's what I'm doing, reading a book a week and talking to the authors about it. And there's some stuff in there that's really interesting to learn. And you don't even have to read the book. You just have to listen to the interview, which is in-depth in an hour.
And I thank you for joining us. This is Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Kierman. I bought some Under Armour shoes. They were on sale. And I love them. So with that said, thanks for joining us. And we'll catch you all next time.
Hey, you. Yeah, you. We're talking to you, and we need your help. As you probably know, independent journalism is a vital pillar of our democracy. Like everything else, it's not free. We're asking all longtime listeners of the show to help support us by becoming a member on Patreon. For the price of a latte, you can help guard democracy. Join us today at patreon.com/JATQ podcast to help us keep bringing you the podcast you love and the facts you deserve.